This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Are schools killing creativity in today's young people? According to Sir Ken Robinson, they are. He has written about getting the most out of your talents, and his new book continues that message.
Plenty of people do things they're good at, but they don't really enjoy it. They just happen to be good at it. To be in your element, you have to love it. And if you love something you're good at, then, as they say, you never work again.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, a conversation with Sir Ken Robinson. We'll also hear how budget cutbacks have changed the lives of some teachers in Chicago, and spend an academic minute hearing how family dinners are good for the soul. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Sir Ken Robinson is an internationally recognized leader and advisor in the development of creativity, innovation, and human resources in education and business. His 2006 TED Talk about schools killing creativity is the most viewed in TED's history. In 2011, he was listed as one of the world's elite thinkers on creativity and innovation by Fast Company magazine. In his best-selling book, The Element, Robinson inspired people to find out what really made them tick and to get the most out of their life and work, creating an intensely devoted following. Now he looks to teach people how to put the core ideas of that book into practice. His new book is called Finding Your Element, How to Discover Your Talents and Passions and Transform Your Life. The Best of Our Knowledge's Joe Donahue spoke with Sir Ken Robinson about why he chose to take the concepts of The Element one step further.
Well, when the first book came out, Joe, as you say, it was very well received, and we had lots of wonderful feedback on it. But naturally, people started to ask me, well, if they haven't found their element, how exactly did they go about doing that? And I really felt I owed them an answer. The first book wasn't meant to offer that practical guide. It was meant to explain what I meant by the element and why it matters so much in people's lives. So the new book is that. It's an answer to the questions I've been asked over the past couple of years, like, how do I find my element? What if I don't have any talents? What if I don't have any passions? Is it too late? What do I do with my children? All the questions that have been put to me, I wanted to bring them together and to answer them as best I could.
So for those unfamiliar, your definition and what you're trying to say about the element is what? What is the element?
Well, the quick background to it is I know all sorts of people. I'm sure you do too. And people listening to this will know too. People who don't really enjoy what they do, they don't enjoy their work very much. They just kind of get through the week and wait for the weekend and perhaps don't enjoy the rest of their lives that much either. And yet, I also meet people, and always have done, who absolutely love what they do. They can't wait to get to it. They get up in the morning and they're keen and excited to get on with it. And if you were to say to them, why don't you change track and do something else for a while, they wouldn't know what you meant. They'd say, but this isn't what I do. This is who I am. And they could be anything. They could be teachers. They could be working in industry. They could be homemakers, they could be working with children, I mean, you name it, there could be anything. If you can think of something that can be done by people, somebody will love it and somebody won't. So to be in your element is two things. Firstly, it's doing things that you're naturally good at, that you have a flair for, a kind of feel for it. But it's more than that, because plenty of people do things they're good at, but they don't really enjoy it. They just happen to be good at it. To be in your element, you have to love it. And if you love something you're good at, then, as they say, you never work again. I mean, people often say, I can't believe I get paid for this. I would do this anyway. So it's that meeting point of talent and passion. And the whole argument is that we all have that potential. Some people have discovered it, and others have not. And it's not that it's not a possibility for them. It's just they haven't yet found their way to that.
And can that happen regardless of what the current culture or environment is?
Well, yes, I think so. I mean, obviously, circumstances play a huge part in this. It's why, Joe, it's why there are so many examples in the book. I'm very keen to make it clear that this is not a theory. You know, I'm not making this up. This is based on very long experience of meeting people in all walks of life, of talking to them, of the response I get. You know, when I did book signings for The Element, I always ask people, what do you do? And it could be anything. I was talking to a lady the other day at a book signing, and she is an insurance agent. She works in the health insurance business. She helps people file claims. And I can imagine some people saying, well, that sounds like a job I couldn't do for very long. But I said, do you enjoy it? She said, you know, I absolutely love it. And I said, why do you love it? She said, because I know I'm helping people. I know that I'm getting them justice for what they're entitled to. And she said, I love fighting on people's behalf. And he said, I absolutely love it. I feel I'm doing something really important. I find it very fulfilling. I've talked to people, you know, these days I wear a brace on my leg since I had polio as a young child. And these days I've been persuaded, because I travel a lot, to get into wheelchairs in airports. I resist this for a long time, but I do now. But I meet all kinds of people who are pushing wheelchairs through airports, and it's amazing how many of them, not all of them, but how many of them, I ask them how long they've been doing it, and they'll say, a chap who pushed me the other day had been doing this for 20 years. I said, do you enjoy this? He said, I love it. He said, I love helping people. He said, I meet so many fascinating people. I love all these people who I meet every day at the airport. I love knowing I'm helping people get through the day. And I always look upon the person I'm helping as if they're a member of my family. I said, I like to think if this were my mother or my brother or my son, that they would be getting this kind of help and support. So, you know, it isn't a single occupation that delivers this. It's finding things that resonate with who you really are. And that's really what I'm trying to do in the book. I'm trying to get people to understand more about themselves, about what drives them, what their energies are, and what lifts their spirits.
And a slight twist on this, which you address in the book, which is finding that thing that you really love, but that you're not very good at.
Yes. Well, that can happen, too, in just the same way that some people don't like things they're good at. There are some people who love things they may not feel that they are very good at. But I'd make two points about this. One of them is that sometimes people say they're not very good at things, and they may be better than they think, but they just haven't yet had the time to really drill down and focus on it, and perhaps they set their own expectations too high too soon. They may be comparing themselves to people who are a lot longer down the track in doing this thing that they're interested in doing. So part of what this is about is having a proper perspective on your own talent early on and what needs to be developed. But the other thing I would say is this, that if you have to choose in terms of balance, there's no doubt in my mind that a passion for something, a strong passion for something combined with maybe a moderate talent will take you an awful lot further than a strong talent for something for which you don't have much enthusiasm. I've found this repeatedly in my life, that if your passion is strong enough, it's amazing what you can get done and what you'll get achieved and how much your actual abilities will increase because they're being driven along by your own sense of passion and ambition.
One of the things I found interesting was the role that teachers and parents and guardians have, and basically being a role model, certainly, but also a tour guide to help people with their element. But ultimately, it is up to that person, isn't it?
It is, yes. I mean, I think it's very important to accept that we all have our own lives to live and we're responsible for them. It's too easy to blame circumstances. I mean, I'm not idealize this. I'm not taking some Pollyanna attitude, you know, this will all be a fairy tale. It's not. I mean, it's why there are so many stories in the book of people who aren't celebrities, they're not famous. I just describe the lives they're actually leading and the obstacles they've had to overcome, and they're often very considerable. But in the end, you have to take responsibility for your own life. It doesn't matter who's around you, encouraging you, cheering you on. If you're not prepared to do it, it's not going to happen. And it's too easy sometimes to blame circumstances. I've known people in desperate circumstances who've achieved extraordinary things because they hadn't been willing to give in. You know, they've been indomitable in pursuing the thing they wanted to do. And there are lots of examples of that in the book. At the same time, it often is very important to have people around us who are encouraging us, who are giving us support and advice from different perspectives. I think that the role of mentors in our lives can often be tremendously important. The only caveat, there's a good bit in the book about that, the only caveat I'd have is that very often parents, if we're thinking about our own children, parents offer, or teachers or others, adults, may offer well-meaning advice about how to run your life. But they may also sometimes be wrong about it. It's worth recognizing that. I mean, for example, often I think young people are pushed to do certain sorts, if they go to college, they may be pushed to do certain sorts of courses because, you know, well-meaning friends or advisors will think it's a safe bet. Hmm. You know, they may come up with an idea they'd like to do, and you'd say, well, I don't see how you'll ever make a living from that. You know, I'd like to study music. Well, you won't earn any money from it. It's you really have to pause and ask yourself if you're a parent giving that kind of advice, if you're right or not, because life is not linear. It's not a straight line. Very often, people go on to do all kinds of extraordinary things that you couldn't have anticipated because they started off in a direction you didn't quite understand. And I think it's important to treat people individually, and it's why I'm saying that understanding what drives people, what their passions are, and not treating them as stereotypes, not mixing them up and applying advice that you wish you'd taken to somebody else who might be quite different from you, is one of the skills and arts of being a parent.
How do you figure a walk into this? I mean, there is a little bit of luck, isn't there?
There's a little bit of luck. Well, yes, but, you know, but luck is an interesting thing, isn't it? Luck suggests that it's all about serendipity and accidents. But, you know, there's been a lot of research about luck. There's a book called The Luck Factor, where psychologists have been looking at the attitudes and aptitudes of people who say they're lucky and comparing them to people who say they're not lucky. And what comes out of it very clearly is that people who say they're lucky have a different attitude. They're more willing to take risks. They're more willing to try things out. They're more willing to fail if necessary. They're often more outgoing. They're often more prepared to pursue an avenue that they're not sure where it will lead. People who say they're unlucky are often reluctant to take a chance like that. So there is a very real sense in which we make our own luck. And that's why there's such a lot in Finding Your Element about the importance of attitude and what your outlook is and what you think you're entitled to and what you're prepared to do. At the same time, Joe, I'm not saying, of course, that terrible things don't happen, that accidents don't happen. I mean, we're all feeling very sympathetic and shocked at the events in Oklahoma, the
right.
tornado.
Of course.
The people in Moore didn't invite that tornado, and its effects have been absolutely devastating. Terrible things do happen in people's lives. But what will make the difference ultimately, once this initial shock has passed there and people settle down as they will, because I know the people of Oklahoma very well, I go there very often, is that people will dig down and find deep reserves in themselves, and they will find a way to deal with some of these terrible losses, and they'll begin to rebuild. In the end, what matters most in your life is not what happens to you, it's what you make of what happens to you. And that's a matter of outlook and attitude as well as of aptitude and passion. So it's that mixture of all of those that I think helps us to create a life.
Again, the name of Sir Ken Robinson's new book is Finding Your Element, How to Discover Your Talents and Passions and Transform Your Life. He spoke with the best of our knowledge's Joe Donahue. Still to come, budget cuts and education don't play well together. That's next on the best of our knowledge. Got any questions or comments about the best of our knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past shows again, you can find us online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for the best of our knowledge, number 1185. This is the best of our knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. In late 2009 and early 2010, the state of Illinois first delayed, then failed to disperse the funding it had allocated to the University of Illinois. In response, the university implemented several cost-cutting measures, including a hiring freeze, salary reductions through furlough days, and cuts to programs and jobs. James Nell and Stephanie Whitaker worked as academic professionals in the political science department at the University of Illinois at Chicago when they were told they would lose their jobs. Academic professionals are lucky because their contracts require that they be given a 6 to 12 month grace period before their last day of work. But because they had year-to-year appointments, they're particularly vulnerable to being fired in tough financial times. Independent producer Michelle Boyd crafted this piece as James and Stephanie described what it was like to lose their jobs and how they fared afterwards.
When I came in 1993, my kids were 1 and 2. I was a working full-time mom, and I always knew that I would do that. But at some point, I realized that my family needed me more than we had to have that second paycheck. So I sort of cut my ties with the university for about 6 months before I said, oh, this staying at home stuff is hard. And I actually came back in the temp pool and landed this role in political science 7 years ago.
At first, I worked in financial aid, and then as sort of a junior academic advisor. That was great until the recession of 2002. The university had a budget problem, and many of us in the College of Medicine received T contracts. I was one of them. I was out of work for about a week before I was hired by the political science department to be their graduate advisor.
I didn't want to just work with kids who aren't struggling for something, who aren't, you know, the first in their families to go to college. And I can get that here.
Oh, I felt that I was very lucky and had found my niche. It was a position that I kind of imagined that I might retire in.
I had been following news reports so closely, and every time I turn on the news, another company was letting 2,000 employees go.
So I could foresee that this was becoming an increasing probability that I would go through this difficult thing for a second time.
And then we started to hear rumblings about administrative cuts.
It's kind of like being an insect and seeing the car windshield coming at you in slow motion.
And then it was not just program cuts, it became human resource cuts, you know, people.
My department head on Friday called the four staff members together, said, we're going to have a meeting on Monday at 10. And he didn't smile. You pretty much know what that's about. Not a fun weekend.
Fast forward that now about 3-4 days. Now it's Monday, the week of Thanksgiving, and we're all called in a meeting. And we're told all of the administrative staff in four areas of social science will lose their jobs.
The positions were going to be eliminated, and a pod would be created with five low-wage positions and perhaps a supervisor.
While I was thinking, wow, really? After all these years, I got to find something else. How do I remake myself? You know, you go through, you know, let me start reading my Essence magazines and figure out what new outfits I need. I need to get to the health club and lose about 15 pounds so I can get this new look about me.
The harder moments came, you know, earlier and later. These are the times when you stop, when things slow down and you have a chance to consider, you know, well, what is my future? Am I going to live under a bridge? How ugly is this going to get? Then, you know, those are the most difficult moments for sure.
But what I began to think over the next 30 days or so was, how did this happen to the departments and the department not have a say in it? And I think it was right after that I sent a note to my faculty that said, I hear you guys discuss things all day long on Academy about, you know, telephone changes at the university, parking changes at the university, but all of the administrative staff is let go, and I don't hear anything. Right after that, I think the faculty began to rally.
I talked to my state senator. I talked to my state representative. I'm losing my job because of the Illinois state budget deficit, I think was the main message. Are you going to support a revenue increase?
After the faculty rallied, and they rallied, and they rallied hard, and they marched on Springfield, and they marched on the State of Illinois building downtown, you know, what ultimately happened was only two of us were let go.
And there was no pod, and the salaries were retained, and it was just in the four-person department, we were going down to two.
And even that was very uneasy in the department.
Well, I applied for over maybe 30, 35 different positions. A third to a half were at UIC. I hadn't given up on the place yet.
I've had my T contract rescinded, and I am glad that I still have my job.
I found another position in the 11th hour in November. The physics department hired me.
We never told the boys about my T contract. I didn't want to share it and have it be their fear. Oh my God, our mom's going to lose her job. Are we going to lose our house? That kind of thing.
My colleagues at Wayne State, they're still in the same jobs that they were, or better. They have never heard of a T contract. They only get fired for cause, and none of them have ever been fired for cause. And they have a lot of confidence as a professional. And I feel like I'm kind of wounded but on the mend. And it'll take some time to regain the sense of confidence and security that most people have.
Those people who have said to me, oh, you should just be lucky you have a job. Yes, I am. Yes, I am. I'm grateful for that. But I have not lost the impact of what happens when someone says, your life is going to change. In a year, you're going to be gone.
This piece was produced by Michelle Boyd as part of the series Meet the Budget Cuts, a multimedia project that explores the human impact of state budget cuts. There are lots of psychological benefits to having family meals together, and that's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. For many modern families, busy schedules and extracurricular activities make family dinner a rare event. But as Frank Elger, associate professor of psychology at McGill University, reveals, research is backing up what conventional wisdom has always known about time around the table.
Consider this question. In a typical week, how many times does your family sit down at the table together for dinner? We posed this question to 26,000 young people from across Canada and measured positive and negative aspects of their mental health. Our findings confirmed what common sense might tell you about the benefits of families spending more time together. That is, more frequent family dinners related to fewer emotional and behavioral problems, greater emotional well-being, more trusting and helpful behaviors towards others, and higher life satisfaction. Based on other work in this area, we expected to find that youths who rarely have dinners with their family are at risk of emotional or behavioral problems. But we were surprised to find that family dinners related to every outcome we looked at, including positive dimensions like emotional well-being and pro-social behaviors. As well, there didn't appear to be a magic number of dinners, a threshold above which the effects began to level off. From having no dinners together to eating together 7 nights per week, each additional dinner related to significantly better mental health. More was better, regardless of the adolescent's gender, age, or level of affluence. Of course, these effects could run in the other direction. Young people who have mental health problems might be reluctant to come to the family dinner. Our research also found that these benefits of family dinners were partially explained by open, easy communication between youths and parents. This makes sense. Family dinners are an important time of the day for young people to talk about problems and concerns and to feel listened to. And small differences matter, even in something as mundane and ordinary as the family meal.
That was Frank Elger of McGill University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors on our website, academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Shartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at wamc.org.